Test, test. Test, test. No. Is it testing? You ready? Hey, everybody, please have a seat. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox of Sunday School class. Today is the 16th of July, and Dr. Ross is with us today. Just a word on the schedule. Next week, we'll be talking about Bible prophecy in general. And the week after that, it'll be on premillennialism. And then Dr. Ross will be back for a couple weeks. 2 weeks, I believe. And then we have a couple more talks on Bible prophecy. Postmillennialism and preterism and amillennialism. Ken Samples will be our last speaker. So Dr. Ross will continue his series today. And I think that's enough. Let's just say a short prayer and get things going here. Lord God, thank you for this day and the word we're about to hear from Dr. Ross. Just bless it. Let his words be true to you, honoring to you, Lord. And bless our minds, Lord, and our hearts. We can absorb what he says and use it as our witnessing tools. And with that, thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Ross?
Well, thank you. And let me begin with a review. This is something I really don't want any of you to forget about this series we're doing on Design for Redemption. Yeah, I've written a bunch of books on this. We can get by this. But what we're doing in this series is basically starting with the universe as a whole and then zooming into where we are right now here on planet Earth. And this is kind of how the book Design of the Core is structured. We look at the universe as a whole and seeing that at the whole, we do see that there's evidence, literally, of over 200 different features of the universe that must be fine-tuned, that must be designed to make our existence possible. And we were just discussing a few minutes ago about the anthropic principle. And the anthropic principle is basically the recognition that the universe must be fine-tuned for human light to be possible. And we were just discussing about how in astronomy, it's kind of evolved where the anthropic principle is, well, what do we need to get life? And what they mean by life is, what do we need for bacteria? And then there's a Brazilian astronomer, Dr. Gleiser, who wrote a paper saying, actually, the anthropic principle has evolved all the way down into the prebiotic principle. What kind of design do we need to get amino acids and nucleobases and sugars? And his whole point is, a human being is a lot more complex than an amino acid. The simplest amino acid has only 10 atoms in it. And he was an agnostic astronomer. He says, as an agnostic, what's really going on in our community of astronomers, we're afraid of the philosophical implications of a universe that must be fine-tuned for humans to possibly exist. Because that actually speaks of a designer that designed the universe to make human life possible. And two weeks ago, we looked at the fact that the universe is structured as a gigantic cosmic web, literally millions of bubbles. Along the surface of the bubbles, we see galaxies and galaxy clusters, and how these bubbles are fine-tuned with just the right features to make life possible. And last week, we looked at how we live in an extraordinary super galaxy cluster. A super galaxy cluster is a clusters of galaxies, and how there are more than 10,000 of these that make up the universe, but we live in the one that's fine-tuned with the extraordinary design features that makes her existence possible. Today, we're going to look at the fact that we're in a just right galaxy cluster and a just right galaxy group. When I come back in 3 weeks, we'll look at the hundreds of features of our galaxy that must be fine-tuned, and we need a just right star. We need a just right planetary system where we have to have 8 planets. We now know that every planet in our solar system must be fine-tuned, must be designed to make advanced life possible here on planet Earth. Even the moon has to be fine-tuned in order to make this system of planets orbit the right way. Comet and asteroid belts must be fine-tuned, and we need a just right Earth and a just right moon. So this is how we're going to proceed through this series. Well, today I want to look at the galaxy cluster in which we exist. And this is a zooming in on our super galaxy cluster, the Lanikaia super galaxy cluster, where it's composed of several large clusters of galaxies, the nearest one being the Virgo cluster. And if you read astronomy textbooks, they will say we are part of a Virgo cluster of galaxies. We're on the very outer edge of a Virgo cluster. And that little arrow you see there points to our Milky Way galaxy. And over to the right, you see the core of the Virgo cluster. But the Virgo cluster actually encompasses the local group of galaxies in which we exist. And I finished last week by talking about how the Virgo cluster, the core of the Virgo cluster, is filled with giant galaxies, galaxies many a times bigger than our Milky Way galaxy. And these giant galaxies are ellipsoidal, which means at one time there were large spiral galaxies, but they wound up collapsing into a very dense spherical galaxy. And these galaxies, where you got a dense core like the Virgo cluster, you see further to right, you get a lot of merging events where big galaxies will merge together and become a giant galaxy. And typically when that happens, the spiral structure collapses and you get a spheroidal galaxy. That little star you see there points to one of the biggest galaxies in the Virgo cluster, one that has the name M87. You say, where did they come up with that? Well, M stands for Messier. He was a French astronomer who was looking for comets, but he said, there's all these nebulae we see when we look through telescopes, and I need to make a list of all these nebulae so we don't mistake them for a comet. And so he wound up with, I think, 111 of these nebulae that he classified. Now, this is long before they knew that there were galaxies that made up the universe. There was a time when they thought our Milky Way actually is the entirety of the universe. It wasn't until the 20th century where they recognized a lot of the nebulae that Messier had seen through his small telescope were actually galaxies as large as our galaxy and much more distant. In fact, there was a famous debate that took place at the beginning of the 20th century. There was Harlow Shapley, and I'll say something about Harlow Shapley. His grandson attended this class for decades. But Harlow Shapley was the most famous astronomer of the early part of the 20th century. And there was a debate going on at that time. These nebulae that we're seeing, are they galaxies like our Milky Way galaxy, or are they part of our galaxy? And, astronomers were kind of on two sides of the fence. Harlow Shapley volunteered to defend the position that our Milky Way galaxy was a sum and all these nebulae are simply part of our Milky Way galaxy. Having read his works, I'm not sure he really believed it. On the other hand, what often happens in academia is that you'll get two scientists that debate one another. They don't necessarily believe what they're debating, but they volunteer to put up the strongest defense for the position. And basically, people said, well, Harlow, you know about these galaxies more than anyone else. It doesn't matter what you believe about them. Will you defend the position? And so there's a young astronomer that basically took the position that they were galaxies. Really famous debate. It lasted all weekend. There were about 300 astronomers there listening to the debate, and Harlow Shapley was quite excited that he lost the debate because he said, now we really know for sure that these nebulae are distant galaxies. And if you were here last week, we talked about the Shapley Super Galaxy Cluster. He was the one that was studying these nebulae that proved to be more distant than the Virgo Cluster. In fact, they're way to the right of the Virgo Cluster in this particular image. And it is the nearest and densest and biggest of the super galaxy clusters in the near vicinity of the super galaxy cluster that we're in. Anyway, they named it after him. I don't think Harlow was a believer, but his grandson definitely was. Well, that little star there is where M87 is, and it has a gigantic supermassive black hole. Now, all large galaxies have supermassive black holes. When we talk about our Milky Way galaxy, one of the astounding design features of our Milky Way galaxy is that it has a tiny supermassive black hole. It's so tiny, it only weighs 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. If it's more than a million, they call it a supermassive black hole. And you say, that doesn't sound very tiny. Well, the Andromeda galaxy has the same mass as our Milky Way galaxy. It has a supermassive black hole that is about what you'd expect for a galaxy that weighs 1.2 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. Its supermassive black hole is 140 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. So the supermassive black hole in our Milky Way galaxy, it's underdense by a factor of 40 times. So about 35 times less than it should be. But then there are some of these massive galaxies, giant galaxies, that have supermassive black holes that come in more than a billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. In my book, I refer to these as super, super massive black holes. Not just a million, they're more than a billion. This particular one in M87 has a supermassive black hole that comes in at 6.5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. This is an image of M87 taken, let me pull it back here, taken by a telescope in Hawaii. The Canadian-France-Hawaii telescope took this image, which shows the full extent of M87. And it's a galaxy where you have all the stars in a very dense grouping here. And incidentally, all these little dots of light that you see in this image, those are not stars. This galaxy is so far away, you can't see the individual stars. But you can see the globular clusters. Now, whenever we have a star party, I love to show people globular clusters. There are 152 of them in our Milky Way galaxy. And when you look through a decent-sized telescope, I have an 11-inch telescope. You look through it, what you see is a cluster of stars that fills the entire eyepiece view. I mean, it is really spectacular to look at. And what you're looking at is anywhere from 100,000 to 10 million stars, but they're jammed very tightly together. And incidentally, these globular clusters have black holes at their core. We call them medium-sized black holes. They come in a few thousand times the mass of our star, the Sun. But this one, 6.5 billion. Now, we have 152 globular clusters where we got anywhere from 100,000 to 10 million stars. This particular galaxy has 15,000. So all those little dots you see there, they're globular clusters. So it gives you an idea just how huge this galaxy is. And because the stars are jammed more tightly together, you get a lot of matter that gets collapsed towards the core of the galaxy. And that's what feeds the growth of the black hole. the black hole's gravity is so strong, it's pulling matter in towards it. And so all black holes are getting more and more massive. The older the universe gets, the more massive the black holes become, because they keep sucking matter into their core. And they'll keep doing that until they end their life as a white hole. Because what happens with these black holes is that they're so massive and so condensed that gravity keeps causing them to collapse. There's nothing to stop the collapse of the star. Neutron stars, once the neutrons are touching one another, then the neutron star becomes stable because there's pressure from the neutrons being exerted one another that prevents the star getting any smaller. And so a neutron star is typically about 6 to 7 miles in diameter. So take our star, the Sun, which is nearly 1 million miles in diameter, shrink it down to 6 or 7, that's a neutron star, where the neutrons are jammed so tightly together, they're touching one another. And so we need to think of neutron stars not as a gas, it's like a solid ball of neutrons touching one another. But a black hole is so massive that it actually overcomes the pressure of the neutrons pushing against one another. And so the neutrons are destroyed, and the black hole just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So all black holes are getting more massive. They're also getting smaller. Their density gets greater and greater. And it was Stephen Hawking who 3 decades ago wrote a paper where he basically said, if we wait long enough, black holes become white holes. Because what happens is the gravity of the black hole causes it to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Eventually, it gets down to the size of a proton or the size of a nucleus. And when that happens, the forces of quantum mechanics become greater than the forces of gravity, which means everything that the black hole has grabbed from interstellar space around it, once it shrinks down to the size of a quantum particle, quantum mechanics overcomes gravity, and everything inside that black hole gets spewed out. So you get this massive explosion, what they call a white hole. Now, have astronomers ever seen a white hole? No. The universe is absurdly too young for a black hole to have enough time to collapse to become a white hole. And the more massive the black hole, the longer it takes to become a white hole. You say, well, what's the fastest it can become? Well, the smallest black hole that's theoretically possible is about 3 times the mass of our star, the Sun. That's the smallest black hole that physics permits. And a black hole that tiny will take 10 to the 66 years to become a white hole. So I wouldn't worry about that ever happening. The universe is only 10 to the 10 years old, so we got to wait another 10 to the 56 years before any black hole can become a white hole. Now, astronomers have had a quest for a long time to be able to actually directly image a black hole. And so a black hole, by definition, is that region around this black hole where nothing can escape. The gravity is so strong that even light is not able to escape the gravitational pull. And so the prediction is that when you look at a black hole with a high resolution telescope, you're gonna see a donut. Because outside the event horizon is that distance from the black hole where nothing can escape, not even light. But outside the event horizon, you've got matter being pulled into the black hole, and because of the gravitational forces and the spinning of the black hole, the smaller the black hole becomes, the faster it spins, and some of them spin so rapidly that matter being pulled in is moving at velocities close to the velocity of light, which means you get the black hole actually is converting matter into energy with 10 to 42% efficiency. And so the prediction that Stephen Hawking made 3 decades ago, if we actually get the capability of imaging a black hole, we're going to see a donut, a bright circle of light around the black hole beyond the event horizon, where matter is being converted into energy with 10 to 42% efficiency. Say, how do you get that 10 to 42? The faster the black hole spins, the greater the efficiency of the conversion of matter into energy. So if it's 42%, you get a really bright donut. If it's 10%, not so bright. And the more matter that's being pulled in, the bigger and the more brilliant the donut. Now, astronomers really wanted to image the black hole at the center of our galaxy, but they knew all along that a black hole is only 4 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. They also knew that our black hole at the center of our galaxy is an extremely quiet phase. It's not pulling in much matter right now, which meant even though it's really close, only 27,000 light years away, that it's probably not going to have a very well-defined donut. So they went after this galaxy, saying, hey, it's 6.5 billion times the mass of our star, the Sun. It's pulling in huge amounts of matter. It's going to have a really bright donut. Even though it's 53 million light years away, it's got such a huge black hole, so much matter is being pulled in, it's actually going to be easier. And so this is the image that was published 4 years ago of the black hole surrounding the donut around the M87 galaxy. And how did they image this? You heard Steve talk about his dad last week and how Dave Rogstad was part of a team where they take telescopes around the world, radio telescopes, and link them together. I went into radio astronomy because a big advantage of radio astronomy, when light comes into our telescope, the atmosphere does not disturb the phase information of the waves coming in. So we not only know how powerful the wave is, we know its exact position. Because we know its exact position, we can actually take telescopes that are separated from one another and link them together as an interferometer. And because we have the position information of the waves, we can actually duplicate, use this interferometer to come up with a resolving power, not of a telescope that's 100 feet across, but of a telescope that's miles across. And you know, Steve and his dad, Dave, have been involved for years in linking huge radio telescopes that are 100, 200, 300 feet across, literally all over the world. And so what they wind up doing is using the fact that we got the phase information to build a telescope that's 6,000 miles in diameter. And so the bigger the diameter of the telescope, the greater the resolution you get. And to give you an idea, a lot of people think that the James Webb Space Telescope is the highest resolution telescope that astronomers possess. What's called the Event Horizon Telescope, an array of 16 radio telescopes all over the world that are linked together as an interferometer, its resolving power is more than 100 times greater than anything capable with the James Webb Space Telescope. It's the only instrument in the world that has the resolving power to actually image the event horizon of a black hole. This is the image that was made 4 years ago. This is the image that was published just a month ago, where they took the data of the last, of course, they've been, you know, accumulating data on this galaxy for the past 4 years. Now they're able to come up with a much better image of the one that got published 4 years ago. And here you can see how well-defined the event horizon is. And what they're really interested in is getting a better definition of the donut so they can actually determine. So now they're able to calculate how much mass the M87 is pulling into its supermassive black hole and where that mass is coming from. Notice you see it's extra bright at the bottom, and that actually gets tied into the jet that's being blasted out by the core of the M87 galaxy. This next image by the Hubble Space Telescope looks at the core of M87. And so you say, well, the galaxy is actually a good 100 times bigger than what you see in this image, but they wanted to actually focus on just the core. And you can actually see over to the right a little bit of gas illuminated coming out. That's a relativistic jet that's being spewed out from the donut of the supermassive black hole in M87. And here's a close-up of it, basically showing you that jet that's being spewed out from the supermassive black hole. It's one of the deadliest things that light can ever be exposed to in the universe. And so, thankfully, that jet is pointed away from us. If it was pointed anywhere close towards the Milky Way galaxy, it wouldn't necessarily rule out bacteria on a planet or Milky Way galaxy, but it means there'd be no paradoxes class. There'd be no possibility for human beings. So, aren't you glad that it's pointed away from us? Okay. And even though it's 53 million light years away, that supermassive black hole is pouring out such deadly radiation that it basically means there's no possibility for life anywhere in the core of the Virgo cluster. So a little over to the right, we see the dense core of the Virgo cluster. There's giant, and by the way, M87 is not the only big galaxy with a deadly black hole. There are several others. But basically, that entire core is a place that's uninhabitable because of the radiation. But because we're 53 million light years away, and not only that, it's also because, notice all the big galaxy groups between us and the Virgo cluster. Those galaxy groups are filled with gas and dust, and they basically shield out the deadly radiation coming out of the core of the Virgo cluster. So one of the design features of the Virgo cluster is the fact that we've got quite large galaxy groups. Fortunately, none of those large galaxy groups have a super, super massive black hole in them. But the gas and dust in those groups actually shield us from the deadly radiation coming out of the Virgo cluster. And as you can see where we are, that little arrow, and by the way, if you look at the little dot that's a little bit above our Milky Way galaxy, that's the Andromeda galaxy. So that kind of gives you a sense of scale. The Andromeda galaxy is 2.5 million light years away. The Virgo core cluster is about 50 million light years away. But what you notice in this particular image, there are no nearby large galaxy groups. You do see some small galaxy groups. And so we're actually the smallest of the galaxy groups in the Virgo cluster. I mean, even like the Mafia group, which is the closest, you notice it's quite a bit bigger than our galaxy group, but much smaller than, say, the M94 group, or the M101 group, or the M81 group, or the Sculptor group. And so that's one of the features that allows us to have this paradoxes class, is that the nearest galaxy groups are the smallest galaxy groups in the Virgo cluster, and we happen to be living in the smallest of all the galaxy groups. And that's because we don't exist on a filament. Now, where these galaxy clusters and galaxy groups exist are along the filaments that make up the Lanikaia Super Galaxy Cluster. And as I pointed out last week, when you look at other super galaxy clusters, the filaments are all grouped together. What you see instead in the Lanikaia Super Galaxy Cluster, the filaments are not all aligned. They splay out. And so there's big angles between them. But only along these filaments can you get the large galaxy groups. Now, you say, well, wouldn't we be better off in one of those voids? Because notice there are big voids everywhere. By the way, all the voids have got names too. So even the empty places, astronomers like to assign names to them. But you can't have life in a void. There's simply not enough dwarf galaxies there to funnel sufficient gas and dust into a big spiral galaxy to maintain the spiral structure. So I mentioned last week, if they don't get a sufficient diet, the spiral structure collapses after 3 or 4 rotations, and it becomes one of these compact ellipsoidal galaxies where the stars are too close together for stable planetary orbits, and the stars are too close together to avoid deadly radiation. Now, what's unique about the local group, it's not on one of the big filaments. In fact, it's not on a filament at all. but it's on the nexus of three subfilaments. And typically, if you're on that subfilament, there's no possibility for a grouping of galaxies to form. We do get a galaxy grouping forming because we're at the nexus of three subfilaments. If we were on a filament, our galaxy group would be too big. If we were on a single subfilament, our galaxy group would be too small. The fact that we're at the nexus of three subfilaments, we have a grouping of galaxy that's just the right size for advanced life to exist. Okay, zooming in a little closer. The core of the Burger cluster is at the extreme right. This actually shows all the groupings of galaxies in our vicinity. And here again, you can see we're definitely in the smallest grouping of galaxies that exist. But in the entire Lanikai supercluster, only the region around our local group do you only see small galaxy groups. Everywhere else, you've got big groups or you've got galaxy clusters. So that's one of the special features. And then we're going to zoom in a little bit more. And I think this next one actually shows you, yes, that little red oval there, that shows you the boundaries of the local group. So it's, again, doesn't have a very big, it's a little less than 5 million light years in diameter. And if you look carefully there, you notice it contains only two big galaxies and no giant galaxies. Typically, galaxy groups have at least one giant galaxy. Ours has none. No giant galaxies. If we had a giant galaxy in our grouping, again, we couldn't have the Paradoxus class. It wouldn't allow human life to exist. We'd be too close to one of those supermassive black holes that's pouring out deadly radiation. So I think I've got... Come on, what happened here? Do I have the right one here? I got so many versions of this. All right, let me zoom in on this one. My slides are out of order, but let me pull. What happened here? Come on, here we go. You won't find this on the internet. I had to produce this map myself. This is a map of our local group, and it's all to scale. So you see the Andromeda Galaxy at the upper left. Our Milky Way galaxy is at the lower right. And I also show the five largest dwarf galaxies. Two of them are in the vicinity of our Milky Way galaxy. They're below, that's the large and small Magellanic Clouds. And over here you see the Triangulum Galaxy. It's a small spiral galaxy. And then if you look at the Andromeda Galaxy, it's actually got two dwarf galaxies associated with it. One to the right, and one to the left. Those are the only five big dwarf galaxies in our local group. Now, in addition, there's 200 tiny dwarf galaxies. But those 200 tiny dwarf galaxies don't show up in this image. They're too faint to be seen. They're much tinier than the large dwarf galaxies. And 5 years ago, astronomers thought that this galaxy ranked number three. I mean, it's quite big. It's large in space, but it turns out not to be that great in mass. And so it's now been demoted. It's now the fourth biggest dwarf galaxy. Number three is actually the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's a tiny galaxy in terms of its size, but it's very massive. Actually comes in at 250 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. So, and the Milky Way galaxy and the Andromeda Galaxy are both the same size. They both come in at 1.2 trillion times the mass of our star, the Sun. The Large Magellanic Cloud comes in at number 3 at 250 million. This particular galaxy comes in at only 100 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. So it's actually 2.5 times less massive than the Large Magellanic Cloud, but its stars are spread out much farther apart. And then that's number 4. Number 5 would be the one that you see off to the right of the Andromeda Galaxy. And then you've got the one just to the Small Magellanic Cloud comes in next, then finally what's called NGC 205 off to the Milky Way Galaxy. But what's unique about our local group is that you got two large galaxies, but look how far apart they are. Very far apart from one another. We don't see that in any other groupings of galaxies, where you got large galaxies that are close together. Now, incidentally, this is not permanent. The Andromeda Galaxy is headed towards us. Not on a straight line, but it eventually will straighten out, and if we wait long enough, the Andromeda Galaxy is going to collide with our Milky Way Galaxy. But it's not going to happen anytime soon. 4.5 billion years from now, the merger event is calculated to take place, and that'll be slightly after our star becomes so big that it vaporizes planet Earth. So hey, I don't make any long-term investments, because eventually all your investments will be vaporized when the Sun becomes a red giant star. But what is really amazing, given the fact that both the Andromeda Galaxy and our Milky Way Galaxy are about 13 billion years old, they're very old galaxies, yet look how far apart they are. Again, we don't see it anywhere else, but if the Andromeda Galaxy were any closer to us, it again would rule out advanced life. In fact, we'd be in trouble if the black hole in the Andromeda Galaxy were in a normal phase. Fortunately, for the last million years, it's been in a quiet phase. Quiet enough that it doesn't make advanced civilization impossible on the Earth. We know it's just a matter of time before the black hole in the center of the Andromeda Galaxy begins to pull in a normal amount of matter. And when that happens, bacteria will be possible. You'll still be able to have grass and trees on planet Earth, but not human beings. But right now, it's in a quiet phase. And hey, when we talk about our galaxy, and what's amazing is our own black hole also is in a quiet phase. In fact, everything is quiet right now during this window of human existence. There are no nearby supernova eruptions. The Sun's in its most quiet phase it's ever been in. The black hole in our Milky Way Galaxy is in its quietest phase. Likewise, the Andromeda Galaxy is in its quietest phase. And now the jet in M87 is pointed away from us. And so what I document in Design to the Core, there's over 24 time windows where everything is quiet and they all simultaneously overlap to make sure we can actually have a paradoxes class in the 21st century. Or to have even human life possible within the last few tens of thousands of years. Okay, I've gone a little bit past my 30 minutes, so we'll take the remainder of the time for questions and discussion. And I'll take any question on any subject, and we're going to alternate between people here in person and those that are participating online. Look, yes, we got a question over here.
You show us in the first picture where the Earth is in relation to that cluster of stars and everything.
The very first where the Earth is in our galaxy? Okay, let me show you this slide here. This is a map of our Milky Way galaxy, and we're in between the Perseus and the Sagittarius spiral arms, about halfway out from the center of the galaxy. When we talk about our Milky Way galaxy, when I come back in 3 weeks, I'll actually show you exactly where our solar system is in our Milky Way galaxy. But it's another fine tuning. We're in the one location in the Milky Way galaxy where advanced life is possible. So all those other hundreds of billions of stars in a Milky Way galaxy, they're non-candidates. We happen to be in the one spot where advanced life is possible. Okay, we have a question from the internet.
Craig McMahon, he asked, the JWST recently found three dark matter star candidates. However, if there are such stars, wouldn't there be dark matter black holes also? And if so, wouldn't they be visible due to any ordinary matter being pulled in?
Okay, what we're going to talk about in this class is how astronomers can detect big dark matter halos that surround the big galaxies. There's been speculation about dark matter stars. You can look at a debate I had with an atheist astrophysicist in a paper I got published. It's called Black Holes as Evidence of God's Care. If you Google that, you'll get a link to the paper, and you'll see a debate that went back and forth between me and one of the reviewers, where the reviewer was claiming black holes don't exist. Instead, we have these dark matter stars that behave like they're black holes, but they're not matter compressed of protons and neutrons. It's compressed dark matter. And the problem with people who claim that there's these dark matter stars is nobody's been able to figure out how to make them stable. If we're talking a giant halo, we can make that stable. But to have a star that has all the characteristics of behaving like a black hole, the problem is we're not able to figure out how to make it stable. So for example, neutrinos are dark matter particles. And so astronomers have speculated, just like we have a neutron star, maybe we can have a neutrino ball, where you've got these neutrinos jammed tightly together and touching one another. But no astronomer has been able to figure out how to make such. No astronomer can figure out how to actually have one of these neutrino balls form, let alone how they did form, how they remain stable. So yes, what you'll see in the scientific literature is a lot of skepticism. In fact, what you'll see if you go online and look at that written debate between the two of us is that I went through the scientific literature. I think I found 27,000 published papers on black holes, only 8 papers on dark matter stars. And all those 8 papers basically said, we got no observational evidence, and we haven't got a theoretical framework on how to make this possible. Look how fun the math is. So, and by the way, there are articles, there are journals that actually allow the scientists to publish highly speculative claims because the math looks really fun. So mathematically, we can figure out how to make one of these things happen, but we can't figure out how to make it form or how to keep it stable. Similar to the problem we have with wormholes. Wormholes, we can mathematically conceive of them, but physically, there's no way that you can actually have a wormhole form or to have it stable. If you're not familiar with the term, a wormhole is where you got two black holes where the singularity at the core of each black hole perfectly touches one another, so you can travel from one space-time realm outside the maw of one black hole, go through and come out in a different space-time realm. I think it was Battlestar Galactica was based on the idea that there was a wormhole where you could travel from one space-time realm to another. So yeah, space travel is mathematically conceivable, but physically impossible. So you're stuck in the time frame you're in. With one exception, we could take a volunteer from this class and send them to the Andromeda Galaxy at 0.999% the velocity of light, have them spend a year there and come back here. They could do all that in less than 30 years. They would age 30 years, but all the rest of us have been left behind waiting for you to come back, we would age by 5 million years. So don't volunteer to take such a trip, because when you come back, you're not going to know anybody. Okay, next question.
Okay. You mentioned earlier about the white hole, how a white hole could form and enough matter falls in, and then you said something about how it would be at the size of a proton or smaller. Now, I've heard, you know, I've heard a lot about the singularity being infinitesimally small, maybe like the Planck length or even smaller than that. So maybe you could comment about some of those different ideas.
Yeah, there's some discussion about, well, how small does a black hole need to become before it can become a white hole? We don't have a worked out theory of quantum gravity, so we don't know exactly what is the maximum size of a black hole before it becomes a white hole. But we do know it's on the order of the dimensions of a quantum entity. So something, say, on the size of the nucleus of an atom or smaller. But exactly where in that range, we don't know. And people have always asked me, well, what would it take so we could actually give a precise answer to that? Well, if we had a particle accelerator that was 13 billion light years long, we could get you an answer. But the chances of that being funded in the relatively near future are considered to be remote. Don't think we can borrow enough money for that.
Right. An online question here from Susan. Can you say a word about how scientists are now saying our solar system is the rarest in the Milky Way galaxy?
Good question. And what you've seen in the scientific literature is what's called the rare earth doctrine. In fact, there was a book published by an atheist paleontologist and an agnostic astronomer, Peter Warden Don Brownlee, and it was titled Rare Earth. And the book has sold really well. In fact, we sold it at Reasons to Believe. And so lots of astronomers and physicists are aware of it, and it's produced what's called the Rare Earth Doctrine. Yes, there could be a trillion planets or 100 billion planets in our Milky Way galaxy, and many of them will be the size of the Earth, but in terms of finding a planet that's sufficiently like Earth that we could have advanced life on the planet, basically what Don Brownlee and Peter Ward said, it's not going to happen. Way too rare. The probability is essentially zero, although they held out hope that we might find a planet somewhere in our Milky Way galaxy or somewhere in the universe where maybe a bacterium could survive. Or a virus could survive. But certainly nothing as advanced as plants and animals or human beings. So that's the rare earth doctrine. And it has evolved into where we now have what's called the rare galaxy doctrine, that our Milky Way galaxy is rare. In fact, that's kind of the theme of Design to the Core. It's not just a rare earth doctrine. We have a rare star doctrine. We can't find any star that's sufficiently like ours to have a planet orbiting it in which advanced life is possible. And what Susan's talking about is they now have what's called the rare planetary system doctrine. In fact, I'm going to talk about that here in this series, how we're now able to see in sufficient detail other planetary systems. And the prediction made back in 1995 when they were discovering the first of planets orbiting other stars, is that all these planetary systems will be very similar to our planetary system. The shock is that's proven not to be correct. We found nothing that looks anything close to our planetary system. So that's what led to what's called the rare planetary system doctrine. And what I'm going to be sharing with you is what's really rare about our planetary system. We have four rocky planets. They're all way too dense for where they are relative to the sun, and they're far away from the sun. You know, as we discover rocky planets orbiting other stars, they're less dense and they're orbiting really close to their stars, so close where they're tidally locked and the temperature extremes are too great for any kind of light to be possible. The other thing that's rare about our solar system is its gas giants. We got four gas giants, and they're nothing like the gas giants we see in other planetary systems. And so I'll be showing you so extremely rare our planetary system is, and how it's got to be exactly that rare for advanced light to be possible. So, and everything, we got the rare moon doctrine, we got the rare comet belt doctrine, we got the only comet and asteroid belts, so everything is rare. So, next question.
Hi. I want to go back to the question that was brought up two questions ahead of me, and that is the transformation of the nuclear star, I guess we call it, and the transformation of it as it continues to, as it proceeds, it goes down to a complete mass composed of neutrons, and that grows and grows until it gets to the mass so that it starts to become transformed into a black hole. Well, in my mind anyway, okay, if you're talking about the packing of those neutrons together, that's going to be the ultimate packing of mass. But then you talk about that neutron star becoming smaller, so we have to be talking about the transformation of that mass into energy, I guess. And so that that transformation now, and to energy, okay, now we know that high velocity, but the high velocity is near the speed of light, transforms the mass into energy. But in that neutron star, what's the mechanism for transforming those neutrons into energy?
Okay, what happens with neutron stars, and you know, we're talking stars that end their burning period with a mass that's less than 1.4 times the mass of our star, the Sun. And they will collapse into white dwarfs. Ones that are bigger than that will go through a supernova eruption. And what happens is the supergiant star throws off a lot of its material as a supernova eruption, but the rest of the star suffers catastrophic gravitational collapse. And where it collapses to such a point that even the electrons and protons are pushed together. And when you push together an electron and a proton, you get a neutron. And so a neutron star, there's no electrons, there's no protons, there's only neutrons, because the gravitational pull is so intense that even the electrons and protons have been forced together to make neutrons. And so a neutron star is a huge solid crystal of neutrons touching one another. Now, that is stable unless it accumulates a lot more mass. If it accumulates a lot more mass, then the gravity becomes so strong, it basically destroys the neutrons and forces even greater collapse. Now you get a black hole. Now, typically a neutron star is not accumulating enough mass for that to happen. That's an extremely rare circumstance. So it raised the question, how come there's so many black holes? Because we see thousands of black holes in our Milky Way galaxy. How come there's so many? We now know the reason there's so many is that if you got two neutron stars that are close together, they will orbit one another. But the gravity is so intense that they lose gravitational energy, and as the neutron stars orbit one another, their orbit shrinks. So the neutron stars get closer and closer together, and eventually they merge. And when they merge, you get a huge shower of energy, like you were describing, the two neutron stars merging together. But you get a lot of energy, but you also wind up with the two neutron stars merging and becoming a black hole. And then if they pull up another neutron star, then the black hole begins to get bigger and bigger and bigger. But initially, how astronomers believe most black holes get started, neutron stars in an orbit with one another that merge together and become a black hole. And astronomers have actually observed this happening. They've used what's called the gravity wave telescope, where they actually pick these neutron star binaries, and they can measure what's happening to the orbit. We can actually see the orbit getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So astronomers use this gravity wave telescope to find two neutron stars that are close enough together that they know they're going to merge soon. And I think at last count, they've detected two separate neutron star merging events where the neutron stars come together. And what we now know is that about a quarter of the elements in the periodic table are created when neutron stars merge together, because you get what's called these rapid process elements forming. So when you look at the periodic table, the elements that are heavier than iron, you get slow neutron capture elements and rapid neutron capture elements. The rapid neutron capture, the only way you can get rapid neutron capture is when you got two neutron stars merged, because what happens is the neutrons get spewed out, they're moving at high velocities, they're bumping into nuclei, and they're making those heavy elements. And by the way, there are two elements in your body that are made by neutron star merging events. So we wouldn't be here unless our solar system happened to form next to a relatively nearby neutron star merging event. So that's why you need to be making sure you got enough iodine in your diet. Iodine comes from, so without black holes, you wouldn't be here.
Well, okay, so basically, the thing that I was concerned about is the transformation of those neutrons into energy. And you say it's the gravity that does that.
What's happening when two neutrons, say it's two neutron stars in an orbit. So as they're orbiting one another, the orbit shrinks as they lose gravitational energy, and the orbit speeds up. So these neutron stars are spinning around one another faster and faster and faster. The gravity wave telescope actually shows you the speeding up of the orbits as they get close enough together. And so they're moving at relativistic velocities, which means they, just before the merging event, they're tearing material off one another. And this is where you begin to see the formation of these heavy elements. And because of the dynamics of the two neutron stars merging together, a lot of material is ejected into interstellar space. And so it doesn't get sucked into the black hole. It's ejected far enough away that the black hole is not able to capture them, gets spewed out into interstellar space where new stars are forming, and these new stars can take advantage of the uranium, the thorium, the platinum, the iodine, the gold, and the silver that were manufactured by the neutron star merging event. So yes, if you got a gold ring on your finger, without the neutron star merging event, you wouldn't have that gold ring.
Okay, yeah, we have one online here. Kit West. Kit, you need to send that question again. It's still a little vague. Sorry about that. But JB Sparks, he says, thank you for teaching it. Thank you for teaching and answers to so many questions. Would it be accurate to say that the Lord suffers the equivalent of eternal hell on a separate dimension of time for each soul he saves?
You can read about that in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, third edition. I also have a video called Beyond the Cosmos, and I've actually got it on my computer here because I'm going to be speaking on that when I'm in Toronto about a week from now. And the talk basically ends by saying, okay, the Bible tells us that Jesus spent somewhere between 6 to 9 hours on the cross. So he died relatively quickly, mainly because of what he went through before they put him on the cross. And so the question is, how could Jesus possibly atone for all the sins committed by every human being who lived in just 6 to 9 hours on the cross? And there are people who pointed out, well, death by crucifixion is extremely painful. In fact, I did a video program with a medical doctor who is also a physicist, and he basically described what you go through and made the point that the crucifixion of Jesus was exceptionally painful. It wasn't a normal crucifixion. You know, he was beaten, and just how strong and healthy he was before he was put on the cross. And because of how strong and healthy he was able to suffer to a greater degree. But the whole point is, even if you add all up, that still isn't equivalent to what we are being forgiven. I mean, what's the penalty for our sins against one another and against God? Eternal torment in hell. And Jesus spoke more about hell than he did about heaven, and basically used analogies to try to describe what the pain of hell was like. And he used the analogy, it's like being burnt alive. And anyone who's been in a serious burn incident knows that's the most painful thing you can experience. Jesus wasn't saying you're literally going to be burnt in hell. He said, this is an analogy. The pain is worse than the pain of being burnt alive. And he said, it's also a place of great discomfort. And the analogy he used was, well, think of lying down where you're not able to move, and you've got these bugs crawling all over your body, and they're biting you while you're alive. That's one of the most uncomfortable things to think about. And he said, the discomfort of hell is worse than that. And so we can't describe the suffering of hell because of how extreme it is. And also, we can't describe the blessings of heaven. So when Jesus talks about heaven, he's giving analogies, but he's saying it's way better than anything I can possibly describe for you. But we deserve that for all of eternity. And not just me, not just you, but every human being who ever lived. So the challenge is, how many humans have lived? Well, a minimum of 100 billion humans have lived and died here, somewhere between 100 billion and 160 billion. So what I've done in the video clip in the book is basically to say, well, the person dying on the cross was a human being, but he was also God. And as God, he was not constrained to the dimensions we're constrained to. We know that as a fact because Jesus appeared to his disciples in the upper room when the windows and doors were locked. And yet he appeared to them physically, which meant he must have had access to other dimensions of space or the equivalent. And so what I've done in the book and the DVD is basically to say, well, I don't know how Jesus pulled it off, but I mean, he created the space-time dimensions of the universe. So if he wanted to, he could spend 6 to 9 hours on the cross in our time dimension, and he could spend infinite time in other dimensions of space. And all you need to do is invoke two more dimensions of time, where you have a plane of time independent of our time dimension, where you got 150 billion parallel lines of time that are all infinitely long. All that can be compressed into 6 to 9 hours of our time. And so the skeptic who says mathematically it's impossible, it is if only a human being was dying on the cross. But if it's God dying on the cross, it's not mathematically impossible. He's the one that created the space-time dimensions, as the space-time theorems now abundantly prove. Now, don't quote me as saying that's exactly how Jesus pulled it off. I'm saying that's one way Jesus could have pulled it off. Given that he can create an infinite number of dimensions and do other things completely independent dimensions, he's got millions of options. That the skeptic cannot say that it's impossible for Jesus to atone for all the sins of every human being who ever lived. It's not impossible. He can do that in 6 to 9 hours of our time. Dave.
Yeah, your little humorous comment about a class of volunteer going to the Andromeda Galaxy brought up a lot of different thoughts in my brain, but I did narrow it down to one question. It's interesting, obviously, that what you talked about, I think that was Einstein that came up with the theory, obviously, or not the theory, but the fact now, obviously, of time travel, people will come back younger. And I actually read a paper where the astronauts typically come back about a quarter of a second younger than when they than the people here on Earth, obviously, because of that. My question then is more about space travel. Is in the past, you had postulated, I believe, obviously, that if we put a human inside like a 1-inch lead box, we could possibly send them to Mars. But I think I remember you more recently talking about that there was a more recent discovery that even a one-inch lead box wouldn't protect our intestines from the radiation of the sun. Is that correct? And could you give us more detail about how we change from a one-inch lead box to a one-inch block isn't going to protect our intestines?
Okay. You'll find an article I've written, posted at reasons.org, where they did an experiment on mice and rats. And mice and rats have an intestinal tract that's an excellent analogy for the human intestinal tract. Notice that mice and rats can eat all the food we can eat. And it's because their intestinal tract is very much like our intestinal tract. And so for decades, medical researchers have used rats and mice as a way to determine how to treat human abdominal problems. Because if it works on mice and rats, it'll work on human beings. And that's been proven to be true. And I look at that as one of the real blessings of our Creator. He gave us animals that are very good analogies for the insides of us human beings. And so we don't have to do experiments in humans to come up with medical advances. We can do them on animals that are good analogies for us. Now, there's no animal that's a total analogy for us. Mice and rats are not a good analogy for our bipedalism, but they are a good analogy for our intestinal tracts. And so they did an experiment where they said, well, let's see what happens to mice and rats when we expose them to the radiation environment we know exists outside of the magnetosphere that's surrounding the Earth. And what they discovered is, if those mice and rats are unprotected from heavy nuclei cosmic rays, which exist once you get outside the magnetosphere, their intestinal tract reaches a point of destruction that is so intense at the end of 3 months that mouse or that rat is no longer able to function. They can't run a treadmill, they can't do anything. They're in so much agony and pain. And after 6 months, they wind up with tumors that basically quickly lead to their death. And so the same thing they said would happen if we put human beings on a spaceship to Mars, which means we're gonna put them on a spaceship to Mars, we gotta find some way to protect them from the radiation from the sun and cosmic rays. And one way to do that is put a thick lead shield around the spaceship. But lead is heavy. And so that means we now got a much more massive spaceship. The other problem with lead is it's relatively soft. And so you got to prevent it from moving. So you need some way to keep the lead intact. And people said, well, water would work. If you got a nice thick layer of water, and water is a lot easier to deal with than lead. And lead's not an ideal shield anyway, because lead is a decay product of uranium and thorium. And so if you've got lead, you're going to have uranium and thorium in the lead. And you get radiation. So you really don't want to use lead. You're better off with water. But now you need a lot of water surrounding the spaceship. Say, how much water do you need? Well, if you've got, say, a 10 or 15 foot thickness of water all the way around you, that'll work. That'll give you adequate protection. But now you're looking at a really big spaceship. You not only have to have a capsule for the astronauts, you got to have this big, heavy water shielding all the way around them. And you better shield that water shield because, you know, if it gets hit by a meteorite that breaks the shell, then all that water escapes, and now you don't have any protection. And so that's the challenge. Not only you need a shield, lead would work, or a lot of water would work, or some other material. Carbon could work if you got lots of carbon. But now you got to protect the shield. You got to keep it from being punctured by meteorites that can come by. So, I mean, James Webb Space Telescope, you want to know why they gave it 5 solar shields? Because they recognize those shields are going to take hits from micrometeorites. And, you know, if you only got 1 shield, after a while, you can't keep the telescope cool, and you'll wind up not getting all those pretty photos. So they made it with 5 shields. And they hope it'll last 30 years. But if they get a big meteorite going through it, it's game over. Same thing with a spaceship. And you say, what do you mean by a big meteorite? Well, big enough to give you a hole that size, that would cause all the water to go out. And by the way, the Hubble Space Telescope, when they went up to do the repair job the two times they did it, in both cases, they found holes in the structure of the James Webb Space Telescope that were the size of, say, a dime, a nickel, or a silver dollar. And you get that hole not from a big meteorite, a micrometeorite, one that you can't even see, moving at the velocity of light will make a hole that big. And you get a hole that big, if you got water, all the water escapes. So there's some practical problems with trying to send people to Mars. And one thing I've written about is, another problem is, you got to give them artificial gravity. Because if you live in a weightless space, basically your body figures out, oh, I don't have to waste so much energy maintaining the bones of this body. There's no gravity to worry about. So the body basically stops sustaining the skeletal structure. And so you lose bone mass. And there was a Russian astronaut who spent several months in outer space orbiting the Earth. He wasn't exercising appropriately. He came back and he wasn't able to survive. So when you go up on the International Space Station, they make you spend 4 hours a day on a treadmill where they give you artificial gravity. But the artificial gravity, I talked to some astronauts and they said, it's very uncomfortable because what they do is they attach bungee cords all over your body. You wear a special suit that's got clips in it and they got bungee cords going down to the treadmill. And so you're running on the treadmill and the bungee cords kind of give you a sensation of gravity. But they told me, it's nowhere near the same. It's not like gravity at all. And they said, in order to prevent bone mass loss, they have to spend 4 hours a day on a treadmill with bungee cords attached to them. And they said, if it wasn't for somebody bossing us around, none of us would do it. Try running a treadmill for an hour. You realize after an hour, you've had enough. It's like, I want off this thing. 4 hours, and you got to do that every day. And also means that's why the astronauts are not that productive on the International Space Station. And by the way, when they get off the treadmill, they basically have had it. They got to take a nap or whatever. Again, I've known astronauts have done this. They said it's not pleasant. Even with that, you lose 1% of your bone mass every month. Even if you do 4 hours a day of bungee cord on a treadmill, you lose 1% and it doesn't come back. That's why they limit the trips to 6 months. Because in 6 months, you lose 6% of your bone mass, and they measure your bone mass before you go up on the spaceship. And if your bone mass is not adequate, they don't let you go up because they know you're going to lose about 6%. Or they say, you only get to spend 1 month up there because you don't have adequate bone mass. If you lose 6%, you can still live a full life here under normal gravity. But 6% is the maximum. You lose more than 6%, then you're going to have big medical problems when you come back here on Earth. Which means if you're serious about sending people to Mars or anywhere else, you're going to have to give them artificial gravity. NASA's aware of that, and so they're thinking about building a capsule where they got a long arm that stretches out and a counterweight, and they make the thing spin, which basically uses centrifugal force to simulate gravity, which, you know, is enough so that you can stand and feel gravity inside the space capsule. But unless that space capsule is really big, the gravity you feel at your feet is going to be much stronger than the gravity you feel at your head. And so if you're working with a space capsule that's, say, 300 feet in diameter, the size of a football field, you're going to have significantly less gravity at your head than at your feet. And that's going to cause serious medical complications. And you don't want to have to face that for very long either. And so the bottom line is, you want the gravity difference between the head of the astronaut and the feet of the astronaut to be small enough not to cause chemical complications. What's the minimum size of the spaceship you need? you need a spaceship that's 10 miles in diameter. So basically they talk about making a giant cylinder 10 miles in diameter, maybe 100 miles long, and then you spin it to generate gravity. And so everybody is pushed against the inside of the cylinder, and the difference between the gravity at your head and your feet is sufficiently small that it's not going to be a problem. But now we're talking a really expensive spaceship. It's got to be 10 miles in diameter, at least 20 miles in length, and then you've got to have this water shielding all the way around it, and you want to have armor plate around that so that the meteorites don't puncture it. Another reason that supports the rare earth doctrine, we live on a planet where we got adequate protection. And so people ask me, well, practically, what's the smallest spaceship you can get away with? Well, something about the size of the Death Star will work. Anything smaller, you've got a problem.
One last question from Marge Harmon. She's in charge of the, I think it's Orange County chapter for RTV. She did, yes. Her question is, what is the answer for Jason Lyle's assertion that the speed of light is actually only measured in one direction? In the opposite direction, it can't be measured, but is instantaneous. This is supposed to explain how, in a young Earth universe, which is his belief, we can see distant stars.
Well, I've debated Jason Lyle three times, and we got a video recording of one of those debates I had with him. And in the first of those debates, this was not an issue. This is something he's developed. When I made the comment in the debate, young Earth creationists cannot solve the light travel time problem. The fact that when we look at a distant galaxy, it takes millions, if not billions, of years for the light to travel across interstellar space and reach our telescope. And in a matter of days, I talk about eight different models that young Earth creationists come up with, trying to explain how we can solve the problem. And one, I remember debating Dwayne Gish decades ago, and he said, oh, I got a solution. The light doesn't come from stars and galaxies. It comes from 6,000 light years away. So God sent the light on the way. But my response to him was, well, astronomers can easily refute that, because when light travels through space, it has to pass through dust and gas. The dust reddens the continuum radiation of the star. The gas broadens the spectral lines. And we look at that broadening and reddening, it tells us the light actually comes from those distant stars and galaxies. Well, you can read a matter of days, but what has been new is Jason Lyle has come up with this idea saying, well, wait a minute, maybe the velocity of light from those distant galaxies comes to us at an infinite velocity, and when light is moving away from us, it's at half the velocity of light. And so he says, because physicists and astronomers can only measure the return path of light, light going out and coming back. We can measure that to very high precision. In fact, we can measure that to 11 places of the decimal. Extremely accurate measurements of the velocity of light. But it's the return path. And Jason has made the point, we don't have a tool to measure the one-way velocity of light. Now, I remember in my latest debate with him, I brought up the point, well, wait a minute, we got these gravitational lenses where you got a galaxy cluster that's gravitationally lensing a galaxy behind it. And that galaxy behind it, you got a supernova eruption. And a supernova eruption is like a clock. It takes about 7 months to explode to maximum light and then dim back down. But what we notice is with this galaxy cluster, different parts of the galaxy cluster will gravitationally lens the light of that supernova eruption along different paths. So you got one path that's almost a straight line towards us. You got another path where it kind of goes like this, another path that goes like this. And so what was published in the scientific literature is how astronomers saw a single supernova eruption at three different times, because the light took three different paths to reach us. And so I brought that up to Jason. He said, well, you know, actually, your critique of my model is not correct, because you were assuming that I was saying the velocity of light is infinite towards the center of the Earth and half the velocity of light away from the Earth. He says, actually, my model is it's infinite towards all observers, because he figured out where it was going to go. What about the James Webb Space Telescope? It's a million miles away from us. And so if the velocity of light is infinite towards the center of the Earth and half the velocity of light away from the Earth, you're going to get a different light path going to the James Webb Space Telescope. And his comment was, no, I'm saying it's infinite towards all observers and all instruments that they use. And then he defended himself by saying, Hugh, you need to understand, I'm a presuppositionalist. And therefore, he's adopted a model that he believes cannot be physically refuted. And my response is, well, that's similar to someone saying, you know, really, I'm only 6 years old. All those memories in my brain, they were implanted there by the Creator. I'm not really 6 years old. I don't have, you know, 70 years of memories in my head. That was all planted there. And, you know, that's an acceptable hypothesis. But it's based on zero evidence. It's simply a presupposition that you're making. And so he says, well, I'm not claiming to be an evidentialist. So that's the main difference between me and Jason Lyle. He's basically saying, I'm a presuppositional. I'm presupposing that God figures out some way to send the velocity of light infinite towards all observers and all their instruments, regardless of where they were. And therefore, and likewise, it says with that supernova gravitational lens, again, that doesn't matter. But it's simply ad hoc. He's basically hypothesizing something without evidence. However, here's one where I think he's in trouble. Because if he's claiming that the velocity of light is infinite from all these different stars and galaxies towards us, half the velocity of light away, how do you explain the fact that when we look at the universe, we see objects of all different ages? We have all these tools for measuring the ages of stars and galaxies, and we see galaxies that are newborn. We see galaxies that are 13 billion years old. We are actually seeing stars being born right before our eyes as we look through telescopes. I put some of them on my Facebook page, where you can actually see these nebulae where astronomers are seeing stars that are brand new. But we also see stars that measure to be 100 million years old, a billion years old, 13 billion years old, 10,000 years old. It's like, okay, the universe is really only 6,000 years old or 10,000 years old. Wouldn't you expect God to set things up in such a way that everything would have an age range between 0 and 10,000? The fact that they have measured ages between 0 and 13.8 billion tells us the universe really is 13.8 billion years old. And I've been at events where Jason Lyle has taken questions from the audience, and there's an astronomer there who jumped up and said, Jason, what do you do about the cooling curves of white dwarfs? And he dodged the question and went on to somebody else. But the cooling curves of white dwarfs, because white dwarfs are burnt out stars. And I'll give you an analogy. Think of an open fire. You've got an open fire, and the wood is burning, and when the wood is burning, the fire flames look like they're yellow and they're white, but eventually all the fuel in the log is gone. And so what you're now having is a log that's not burning any longer. But it was really hot, and so you see it cooling down from its hot state to its cold state. If you wait overnight, that log looks black. But the night before, after it ran out of fuel, it looked like a deep orange color, then it becomes red, then infrared, eventually it goes black. The same thing happens with white dwarf stars. They're stars that have burned up all their fuel, but they're still really hot. And so it takes time for them to cool down. But astronomers can look at white dwarfs and see how much they've cooled. And the cooling times stretch over 7 billion years. So some of them we can tell have been cooling for 7 billion, some of them have only been cooling for less than a million years, and everything in between. Why would you have stars with all different cooling times if the universe is only 6 to 10,000 years old? So that's an issue. By the way, we see no black dwarf stars. None of the white dwarf stars have completely cooled. Why? Because it takes nearly a trillion years for a white dwarf star to become a black dwarf star. So we know the universe is relatively young because none of the stars have become black. They're all white. We don't even see them in a yellow state yet. So the universe is too young for a white dwarf to become a yellow dwarf. Now, there's something new that I think directly challenges Jason Lyle's model, and that's time dilation. Okay, so, and I've got an article coming out on this. It'll be published, next month in July. This is July. It'll be published in August. Okay. And I found that the one equation everybody knows wherever I speak in the world is E equals mc squared. Okay, when you go home, I'm going to give you an algebra assignment. Just using high school algebra, you can use E equals mc squared and come up with the equation for time dilation. And what that tells you is that, and it fits the analogy of going to the Andromeda galaxy, the equation E equals mc squared, which we can now prove to more than 20 places of the decimal by direct measurements, basically says the faster a clock moves relative to clocks on Earth, the slower the clock will tick. And so in a Big Bang universe, the farther away a galaxy is, the faster it's moving away from us, which means clocks in those galaxies will run more slowly than clocks here on Earth. And so we can look in galaxies that are 6, 7, 8 billion light years away, and the supernova that are exploding in those galaxies, instead of taking 7 months to go through their light curve, they take 8, 9, and 10 months to go through the light curve. And the farther away the supernova, the longer it takes to go through its light curve. Now, the time dilation effect is the velocity of the galaxy divided by the velocity of light squared. And so astronomers realize if we're looking, say, 8 billion light years away, the slowing down effect is only 10%. But if we look all the way to, say, 13 billion light years away, the slowing down effect is more than 90%, which means that distant clocks are not going to run 10% slower, they're going to run about 5 times slower. A paper got published last week where they detected that time dilation, that it's actually quasar clocks are running 5 times slower 13 billion light years away than they're running near the vicinity of our Milky Way galaxy. It's literally a factor of 5 times slower. But here's where I think Jason's in trouble. It's the velocity of light divided by the velocity of the galaxy divided by the velocity of light as that light is coming towards us. That really is a one-way velocity of light. It's the velocity of light of the galaxy moving away from us relative to the velocity of light of going away. They're both in the same direction. So, and the whole point is, I don't think you can survive without having to deal with some evidence. And I believe the Bible actually supports that. Everything is to be tested. Hold fast to that which proves to be good. And so a hyper-presuppositional approach, I don't think is biblically defensible. Okay, sorry for the long answer.
Yeah.
But I knew Marge. I know Marge wants that.
She wants a long answer.
She wants a long answer.
thank you, Dr. Ross. We're out of time, but we got a lot of questions left online. How can these people get their questions to you?
Okay, I do take questions on my Facebook and Twitter pages. They will be brief answers, but they're welcome to post there, or they're welcome to put the questions back up again when I'm here, I think.
3 weeks.
3 weeks from today, I'll be back.
So where will you be for the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'm at an event in upstate New York for for the next week, followed by an American Scientific Affiliation conference the week after that in Toronto. And while I'm in Toronto, I'll be doing